Hello, it's Greg Clark here from CPX, and today my guest in the studio is Professor Simon Conway Morris. He's the Professor of Evolutionary Paleobiology at the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of the Royal Society. Welcome to CPX, Simon.
Thank you very much.
Simon's best known for his work on the Cambrian explosion, and his research has taken him around the world, exploring Cambrian soft-bodied faunas in places as diverse as China, Greenland, and even Australia. He's been here a few times before, and we're speaking today with him about evolutionary theory and his book that talks about the place of human beings in an evolved universe and this strange phrase, the song of creation. I'm really looking forward to it. Professor, it's the 150th anniversary of the origin of species this year. Is it a cause of celebration for you or not?
Oh, it's certainly a cause of celebration. I think the origin of species is the foundational text for evolutionary biology, and the arguments which Charles Darwin puts together are so seamlessly assembled. And one's got to remember that from many respects he was dealing from considerable ignorance. For instance, effectively nothing was known of genetics, and much was remained to be understood about the what we call the phylogenetic relationships, you know, how close is an earthworm, for example, to us, or perhaps to a crab. Simple questions in a way which we can now answer, I think, with some degree of accuracy. So yes, The Origin of Species is a very clever book, and it assembles its arguments in an extremely ingenious way. And as the reader goes through that, one feels, yes, that's true. Yes, that's right. What a marvellous set of observations.
And yet it's caused such a mixed response from religious people. Do you think it warranted such a reaction?
Well, even more or less from the first day that The Origin was published, I suppose there was some degree of dichotomy. The fact of the matter is that the majority, I think, of clerics, if you like, Christians, who were intellectually trained, I don't mean to talk down to the ordinary person, but Darwin's arguments are quite deep and complicated, and effectively, no, they had no trouble with it. I mean, this is God's way of making the world, and there were, of course, other people, relatively few, I think, because one's, again, got to remember that the great majority of clerics in the United Kingdom had been to university. They were familiar with Latin and Greek. They understood critical analysis at that stage. But the other view would, of course, be one which more or less revolves around different sorts of fundamentalism and different sort of literal interpretations of the Bible, amongst other things. And certainly to the present day, some people have very considerable problem with Darwinism, but I'm not one of them.
I know you do identify yourself as a Christian believer of types, and we'd love to talk to you about that a bit later. But to start with, your own book, which has the great title, Life's Solution, Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe. To my reading, it suggests that the common view, or you're suggesting that the common view that evolution is a random process with just a vast range of possible outcomes is actually false.
Well, scientists are very careful about using the word false.
Oh, well, you need to be more careful than I can be.
Well, no, it's okay. No, one's effectively saying one's always dealing with hypotheses, and you're absolutely correct that the neo-Darwinian framework largely revolves around the notion that the endpoints of evolution, that is the twigs of the tree, which there are very, very many, are the result of random processes, things like mutation, and history itself, that is geological history, is punctuated by all sorts of sad events like giant rocks falling out of the sky, mass extinctions, which it's argued redirect evolution into radically new directions. Now, I'm not disputing the reality of mass extinctions or the reality of mutation, but I would argue from various lines of evidence that in fact there is a degree of predictability in evolution, perhaps a considerable degree of predictability in evolution. My own thoughts are evolving very quickly in this sort of area, but it's not one which I think is an entirely open-ended process. And
yes, you use the term evolutionary convergence. Can you explain what that means a little bit?
As best I can, certainly. Convergence is familiar to all biologists, and in fact it's one of the best arguments for the Darwinian process, which we call adaptation, that things are honed to function as well as possible. The classic example is we sit in the studio here, and we're looking at each other through our camera eyes, and then I go down to the fish market. I walk past the fish because, of course, we are closely related to fish. They came onto land and we are their descendants. And I go to the slab, which has got all the octopus on it. You have to be not too squeamish to pick up the octopus. I extract the eye. I compare it with the eye inside our heads. And they are very, very similar. That's a nice example of convergence because we know the common ancestor could not possibly possess that camera eye. They've been arrived at the same solution.
A lot of people would be shocked to hear you say that we have evolved from fish. Why are people so shocked by that thought?
well, in a sense, your readers and listeners must write in and question those people. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that, to begin with, we have information from our anatomy, from our embryology, which show that we share a large number of things in common with kangaroos and also lizards and also frogs and also fish. So, therefore, they all fit into a particular group. But more importantly, from my perspective, is, in fact, that we have wonderful examples in the fossil record which are effectively showing how something very much like ourselves with four legs evolved in the Devonian period in an aquatic environment. In other words, limbs themselves, and you can actually have the fossils showing the transformation from a fin into a limb. This structure evolved in an aquatic environment, and only then did it become useful for occupation of land. In other words, again and again in evolution, what you find is something evolves for one function, and then it's co-opted for a different function. And the point of the argument is that although in some creationist, perhaps fundamentalist circles, they will say there are no missing links, I'm sorry to tell you that there, it's not so much that there are or not missing links. The fact of the matter is that we have examples where the fossil record provides a partial, not a complete, because the fossil record is incomplete, but a convincing set of intermediates which join organisms which in fact finally look very different from each other, but we have the transformational sequences in between, and that's beautifully shown in the case of one group of fish, the Crossopterygians or Sarcopterygians coming onto land.
This seems to have consequences for some people in terms of humanity's uniqueness. Now, in the book, you talk about humans or humanoids almost inevitably developing sentience. Does that mean that the human species is unique in some sort? Is it the end of some sort of evolutionary process, or are we just part of the journey?
Very complicated set of questions. I mean, in a certain sense, I would try and answer the second question, which in a way is the more deep. First of all, I don't think we're the end of a journey, because we don't even know what journey we're involved on ourselves. I mean, yes, of course, we are in a planet, and I don't expect our species to change much. It's shown no anatomical change worth talking about for at least 200,000 years. But in terms of our culture, so in a sense, we're moving into a new sort of evolution in terms of our ability to understand the world around us, in part through science, in part through imagination and other narratives. I think we've only just begun our journey, as it so happens. So far as, is it this species? Well, from a scientific viewpoint, all I would say is that if you want me to produce something living on land, walking on two legs, with the capacity to manipulate, with camera eyes, and also a large brain with an intelligence, because those things have evolved independently elsewhere, I think they're things which are very much on the cards, because they're examples of evolutionary convergence. They're things which work well. So actually, I'm much more interested, if you like, in biological properties. So in a certain sense, I'm a bit more like a physicist or a chemist. I want to know what an element is. I want to know what a compound is. I'm equally fascinated in the evolutionary story, because I work on fossils. And one of the most exciting things that I've done, for example, in Greenland, is to find a new fossil and suddenly realize this might be absolutely central to an evolutionary question about the origin of a particular group. So certainly I use evolution, but when I say humans are inevitable, what I'm arguing is that this is a highly adapted functional complex, to speak technically, which has a series of evolutionary antecedents, each one of which is, I think, pretty likely. And overall, I sense that there is a likelihood to this process.
Okay, now where does that take you in terms of the religious discussion? Because I guess one of the very vocal groups of scientists working in your area strongly associates evolutionary science with atheism. In fact, someone like Richard Dawkins will say there's almost an inevitable link between those two things. Where do you put yourself in that debate?
Well, it's extremely complicated. I think perhaps the most generous way to look at it is to remind any scientist that they inevitably have a metaphysics. In other words, we have a series of presuppositions which are foundational to our world picture. And by and large, these aren't ones which we spend a lot of time examining. And I suppose perhaps Richard Dawkins would argue, he should argue, of course, on his own behalf, I'm not here either to defend or attack him, is to say that in the end, the entire world can be explained merely by material causes. And he may well be right, because again, the point about any science is that it's dealing with a series of hypotheses, and any scientist pushes a hypothesis as far as it can possibly go. I would be unwilling to take that particular path at the moment, partly because, as you mentioned, I profess a Christian belief, and that carries with it, if you like, a whole lot of baggage. but I think it's defensible baggage, as it so happens. But more importantly, because I think we're dealing with unfinished business in particular, I mean, one of the central questions to my way of thinking is, I don't really think that we understand the nature of consciousness. And I'm not being mysterious about this. I don't think that this is something we'll never understand, but I rather suspect the science we need will be one which will be a rather different sort of science than the one we possess at the moment. Of course, our materialist colleagues will say, no, we've already explained it. It's sort of there in the brain. But this goes back to a very ancient philosophical discussion, and this is a problem when you're on the fringes of science. You almost invariably go towards areas of philosophy, and there's nothing wrong with that, but these are things which I, as a scientist, am not well equipped to talk about. The final observation I would make is, rightly or wrongly, the materialists would probably say it's a delusion, but for all intents and purposes, religions are a human universal, as are indeed other things like music. Now, that may simply be that when you become self-aware, things like one's own mortality stare you in the face. But I think to the very first approximation, although mortality and death and grieving and the disposal of the dead are central to the majority of religions, overall, the sense of religion I have, and I'm speaking as broadly as I possibly can, well aware that there'll be atheists and Buddhists and Muslims listening, I suppose, is the idea of transcendence, the idea of the other, the idea that in a sense there is a structure to the universe which we're invited to join.
Does your theory of convergence contribute to your belief in God, or are they absolutely separate things?
They're not absolutely separate, but they certainly don't depend on each other. All one says is that I think we can see consistencies. I'm aware as a scientist that many of my previous ideas have been shown to be just gloriously wrong, and I think it's true of any religion, in fact, and especially Christianity, which makes very specific historical claims. In a certain way, when I have a scientific hypothesis, I am offering a hostage to fortune. I know perfectly well that a very bright graduate, possibly driven by the fact I've said something controversial, will do his best to disprove my idea, and that's the way the science progresses. Well, religion doesn't sound the same, but it too, I think, has a historical dimension, and in the case of Christianity, I say it makes these very specific observations, I mean, most famously with the resurrection. How do we combine those two? Well, I prefer to look at it in a rather different way, which I hope would be an attempt not to reconcile, but at least to find we have more in common, that is, people who are scientists and people of faith. To the first approximation, it seems to me that possibly in science there's a very great deal we don't know. And this is not to say it's mysterious or somehow obscure or somehow new age or anything like that. It's simply that perhaps there's a vast amount. I mean, an example I often like to use is I'm told, reliably, that the physicists or cosmologists have just lost about 93% of the visible universe. Dark energy, dark matter are there.
It's very irresponsible of them.
It is indeed, absolutely. It's a heavy burden, as they say. But it's got to be there in some form, otherwise, you know, the observation of the way galaxies behave, it doesn't make any sense. So one suspects that there is a new sort of science waiting to be uncovered in some aspect of physics. So too with evolution. I have absolutely no trouble with evolution at all. Of course, it happens, and I'm delighted to be able to contribute in my own small way to the unravelling of various parts of the story. But there too, I think we might be dealing with unfinished business, in as much as evolutionary convergence, to my way of thinking, apart from anything else, as you indicated, indicates that there may be some degree of predictability in this business. Now, again, I could be wrong, but I'm very happy to put the idea to the marketplace. And I think that actually the overall interest in evolutionary convergence amongst the scientists is beginning to grow.
One of the very difficult questions that often comes up in these discussions is what you might call the ugly side of nature or the ugly side of creation. What does someone like you, a professor in evolutionary theory, do with all the waste in the universe, all the sense of meaninglessness and the horrific kind of waste of resources that the universe seems to be?
Well, at one level, there simply is not an answer to it. And if somebody comes along, either as a scientist or a theologian, and says, I've sorted it out, I would be, to put it mildly, surprised. I think you could make some observations, though, which are not necessarily very helpful. To begin with, if it's genuinely a waste, it's genuinely meaningless, and indeed if our lives are genuinely meaningless, then I think that's ultimately an appalling prospect. Now, again, materialists and perhaps atheists or agnostics may say, here's this poor chap who's hanging on to this small life belt in this vast ocean of chaos. That may be the case. However, one could take a different sort of view and say, and this is especially true of the Christian argument, that we are still dealing with unfinished business. And this is absolutely no use to anybody, say, who's coming back from the doctor's surgery and they've been told they have a cancer and they have got 3 weeks to live, which sometimes happens. These are not meant to deal with these sorts of things. Overall, what one's trying to establish is a framework. And it seems to me that natural evil, as it's called, is just an inevitable consequence of the way the world is. It cannot work unless mountains fall on top of people. Tsunamis obliterate islands, because otherwise we wouldn't have plate tectonics, as often been observed, and therefore ultimately this planet would not be habitable. I think far more serious is actually the problem of human evil, and I sometimes wonder whether those people who say that it's either meaningless or perhaps simply due to inappropriate social behaviour or training have necessarily fathomed how appallingly bad people can be. And also, I mean, I don't want to get into this area in any detail, it's people like you and me, or certainly people like me, who sometimes find themselves in societies where they join gleefully in the killings and so forth. And that tells me that there is a deep fracture through the world. And again, metaphysically, that's something which accords not with an answer, but there is a Christian argument there to suggest that this is something which is cosmically deep, goes far, far beyond Genesis or anything like that, and therefore is an area which at least we can reopen a discussion.
When you look at the world through the eyes of a scientist, as you've so beautifully done there for us, but a believing scientist, does your view of the world lead you to a particular view of God, or doesn't it work like that?
Well, it's not for me to say. I mean, I think sometimes the debates we have between some of my colleagues who are materialists and perhaps even some people who profess a belief in a God is, I'm not to say who people should believe in a manner of speaking. I think sometimes, and maybe this is a problem which comes with the close debate between creationists and evolutionary biologists, is that with great respect, both of them may have an idea of God which is not quite familiar to me. I mean, to go through the usual medieval litany, God is completely other. He's not like us in any sense at all. I mean, we are privileged to see him, if you like, and we regard the universe as his gift and his creation, and one which is ultimately good. And this, I think, falls well into Christian orthodoxy. And that, again, is the absurdity of Christianity, the nonsense it appears to be that via the incarnation we have actually the visitation of God himself here. And again, from any perspective, except perhaps that which takes on board those ideas, from evolutionary biology, from the age of the Earth, from the size of the universe. These sorts of things seem completely absurd. Until we remember, though, that perhaps, you know, the world is constructed differently than we would like it to be. And more important, as I've already mentioned, if science is an open-ended business, so is theology. And I think that in their different ways, science reveals the most extraordinary things and will continue to do so. And I think also that's true of theology. They have a little bit in common.
Is it true that at the highest levels of science at which you work, as some people claim, there are the more senior the scientist, the less likely they are to believe in God? Is that statistically true? It's often quoted at us.
Well, I don't have any data to hand, so I therefore cannot speak as a scientist.
Okay, speak personally in your experience.
My experience, and I believe various censuses have been done and surveys and so forth, and I think it is true that if one looks at, let us say, the members of the National Academy or the Fellows of the Royal Society, then probably there are more agnostics percentage-wise than there would be, let us say, in the general population.
You say agnostics, not atheists?
Well, I suspect there are relatively few atheists and many agnostics, because in a certain way agnosticism is at least some degree of uncertainty, because after all the evidence is conflicting, and if one was a Christian one would say, well, hang on a minute, I've got to subscribe mostly, so it appears, until one engages with other arguments such as prayer. But one's dealing with documents which, you know, come through human hands and of course come through different hands and so on and so forth. It's not for me to say why indeed some of the very greatest scientists are atheists, but I think it's also the case some of the greatest scientists in the past and today are also believers of one sort or another. And beyond that, I dare not say anything, because people of the very highest intelligence don't necessarily have intelligence in all areas. It's, you know, that sounds a rather sweeping comment. But, you know, I think there are a whole complex set of issues. And it's also, I mean, in the nature of the society in which you live. If the majority of people you know tend not to profess or indeed express skepticism, then sometimes it's easier to sort of belong to that group of people, because after all it seems to accord with your sense. If you live in a community where it's taken for granted that God exists, then I think the what matters is all the time, you know, you yourself are free to choose, and I think one always keeps one's mind open.
I think we often feel that we live in a society where it is accepted that God doesn't exist, and that you are not to have that belief in the laboratory, at least. How do you cope as a believer in your among your colleagues in your scientific environments? Is it difficult?
Not at all. Well, it might be in some countries, and it might be in certain circumstances. But I mean, Cambridge itself, where I work, has been described to me by others as, quote, a Christian city. That is, we have a college system, and practically every college, for instance, has a chapel. That doesn't mean, of course, many people go to that chapel. But nevertheless, the arguments there, when one looks into the past, the history, and also to the present day, is, for example, in Cambridge, we have the very successful Faraday Institute. Now, that's headed by two scientists, Dennis Alexander and Bob White, both of whom I know, and I contribute to their sort of work. I suspect that quite a few of my colleagues who are agnostic, I'm not sure I know many genuine atheists, there are a few, of course, probably look at me more in sadness and sorrow, if you like. They just think, well, that's a shame, this poor chap has, you know, slightly lost the plot here. But never, ever would one get any sense that, you know, one was an abuse of either the privilege of being an academic or that one's living on a different planet. They simply, in a way, the tuning is just slightly different.
One last question for you brings us back to where we started. You have described science as something like discovering the song of creation. Is it a beautiful song?
Oh, most definitely.
Simon Conway Morris, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.